Our next matter is Borough of Englewood Cliffs versus Thomas Troutner. May we have appearances of counsel, please?
Good afternoon, members. Scott Salmon from Guardian. My attorney, Salmon Sprague Susser, on behalf of the Borough of Englewood Cliffs.
Good afternoon, members.
Good afternoon, Matthew Boxer from Lowenstein Sandler, on behalf of the respondents, Thomas Troutner and Kieza Shahinian and Gia Tomasi Law.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Albert H. Warnsch, WUNFCH III, Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, on behalf of Albert H. Warnsch III.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mr. Rosenberg, I'm pleased to be here.
Thank you. Mr. Sam.
Thank you, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes. The question before the court is whether a public entity may be held liable under the New Jersey frivolous litigation statute. The Borough of Englewood Cliffs submits that public entities are immune from that liability. In this case, the borough did what most lawyers can only dream of from one of their clients. They took their lawyer's advice. After settling one lawsuit, the borough hired one of the oldest and most well-respected law firms in the world, Cadwallader, Wickersham, and Taft, and asked them if their previous counsel had committed malpractice. The borough was advised that the previous counsel had, and so they filed a lawsuit. It was quickly dismissed, and the borough was sanctioned under Rule 148 of the New Jersey Rules of Court. Through that, the respondents want to rely on the frivolous litigation statute to go after the taxpayers for their fees and costs. I want to start off with a textualist argument before moving to some background principles like sovereign immunity and the presumptions in favor of public entities. At its core, our argument boils down to this. Public entities are fundamentally different than other types of litigants and cannot be held to the same rules that apply to everyone else unless explicitly stated by the legislature. There is nothing here to show that the legislature intended to allow taxpayers to be punished for frivolous litigation. In terms of our textualist argument, in subsection A of the FLS, the legislature refers broadly to parties that are able to seek fees and costs based on the claims of non-prevailing persons. Using the plain language meaning and importantly, the context of the word persons in relation to parties, we believe that this language was intended to limit the universe against whom frivolous litigation sanctions may be recovered. If the legislature intended to say that all parties may have attorney's fees recovered against them, then they would have said that. They chose not to use that word. They chose to use the word persons, the only time in the statute that they do so, and that should be recognized by this court. We believe, as Judge Fisher did in the PM case that we cited in our briefs, that this interpretation is strengthened by the addition of subsection A2 and the modification of subsection C in the 1995 amendments to the statute. The two sections introduced the phrase public entity into the mix, distinguishing them from any other type of party. To the borough, we believe that you would need to squint your eyes, tilt your head, and pretend that some of the words are different than the ones that are written on the page to conclude that they are the same. To find otherwise, the court would need to believe that a person is the same as a party under A1, and the legislature separated parties from public entities under subsection C for no reason. In other words, if public entities were to be treated the same as everybody else under the FLS, why would the legislature even need to modify subsection C to include them as a separate type of litigant from all other parties? From a textualist perspective, their distinction as to the types of litigants shows that public entities should be treated differently from other parties. One striking fact is that the legislature never acted after the PM decision to correct it if they believed that the decision was wrong. That must weigh heavily in the borough's favor when determining what the legislature intended here. The appellate division disregarded this in a one-sentence footnote. We shouldn't even really call it disregarded it because it was more of a passing mention of the fact. I think that if this court believes that the lack of action by the legislature is not relevant, then an explanation is warranted because the appellate division doesn't provide one. In terms of the general principles of sovereign immunity, I completely understand how this is going to sound, but everyone other than me is wrong about this. The court in KLF, the appellate division, the respondents, the ACLU, they all argue that for public entities to be immune, that must be expressly stated in the statute. They argue that the FLS does not declare a public entity is immune from sanctions and that it must do so for them to be immune. This is fundamentally backwards. Sovereign immunity is the presumption unless expressly waived by the legislature. Again, immunity is the default. Non-immunity is the exception, and it must be expressly waived. Nobody on the other side of this argument, stretching back for more than 30 years, has ever provided a justification for why the presumptions of sovereign immunity should be reversed in this case. When the court dealt with the Tort Claims Act, the Law Against Discrimination, the Conscientious Employee Protection Act, in the Lehman, Abamont, Cavawati, and Pritchett cases, just to name a few, they analyzed the language to determine that the legislature had expressly waived sovereign immunity for punitive damages. The TCA has an entire section on why the legislature waived sovereign immunity in those cases. I think it is incumbent on the respondents to justify how the court can analyze statutes such as those ones for that intent, but not do so here for this one.
So there's case law from the U.S. Supreme Court that 11th Amendment sovereign immunity applies to the United States and to states which retained their sovereignty at the time of the founding, but does not apply at all to municipalities. So from where do you get the idea to begin with that municipalities enjoy sovereign immunity and have since the time of the founding?
So there was a case, I don't have the full citation here in front of me. There was a case we cited in our papers from 1840. I believe it was the Schrader case that stated that because
Sorry, you said from 1840.
Okay. Yeah, correct. The Schrader case. It was in our reply brief. It has been understood in New Jersey, at least, that because the municipalities are creatures of the state, their sovereign immunity, that type of immunity flows from them. Their rights and obligations flow from that. I would also
say U.S. Supreme Court case law, I think, is precisely to the contrary in that it says because states retained their sovereignty at the time of the founding, they have sovereign immunity, as does the United States. But because municipalities are simply creatures of state law, they don't have sovereign immunity. So why, if municipalities are creatures of state law, would that provide them with sovereignty?
I think that was, you said that was under the 11th Amendment. So I think this is under, I'll say, the state common law versus under federal law. I think that's what you were.
But then state common law is not constitutional, correct?
State common law is not constitutional. I suppose it depends on. I suppose I don't know. I guess I would need to read what case you're referring to. I'm not sure which case that is.
Okay.
Your adversaries say that the 1995 amendments that added the language public entity to sections 59.182 and 59.1C was added for a very narrow, discrete purpose, and that was to enable a public entity to recover costs when the public entity was not a party, but was in the case in defense of an employee who was sued. Why are they wrong?
Well, I think that is why the legislature did make those amendments, but at the same time, they also didn't make any other. First of all, they didn't make any other amendments to the statute as well. They didn't change the language of A1, which is really the operative one here. But I guess we only get to the intent of the legislature and why they were doing that if the language itself is ambiguous. If it is clear, then it doesn't even matter what the intent of the legislature.
But if that's the purpose of the addition of the words public entity to those two sections, then why is it relevant to this situation, which is obviously a very different situation?
Why is it relevant? Because, well, before we get to the intent, we look at what the text says, and the importance of it is in that, I'll say primarily in that subsection C, where it adds the phrase public entity. And that section does not just apply to those specific types of claims. That applies to any claim.
But it specifically says a party or public entity seeking an award under this section. That's the language you're referring to, correct?
Correct. Yes.
And the plain language, you were saying we should look to the plain language of 2 says when a public entity is required or authorized by law to provide for the defense of a present or former employee, the public entity may be awarded all reasonable litigation costs if the individual for whom the defense was provided, dot, dot, dot. So why was it not just necessary for the legislature to add the words or public entity to C to allow a public entity who was not a party to the case and therefore would not have fit under the words a party seeking award, but was still defending its employee, a present or former employee, and thus was entitled to request costs under the new A2?
Because the language of all parties in C would still include them as a party that is seeking the award, not a party necessarily to the case itself. They are still a party that is seeking an award.
But what makes you think party if it's just, I think you agree that the purpose of the amendment was to include the specific instance in which a public entity was not a party to a case, but was providing a defense for a current or former employee. So it seems that the inclusion of a public entity in C is referring back to A2, which indicated that a public entity in the circumstance where it was not a party could seek these damages.
So I think parties are used, the word party is being used in two different contexts here. In the first part, in A1, for example, it's being used in the context of a party to the case itself. In C, party is being used in the context of any...
You're referring to A2. A2, where that language appears?
No, I'm sorry, A1.
One is a party who prevails in civil
right. action. Okay. So, and that's referring to a party of the case itself. The the use in C is referring to a party that is seeking an award.
But the whole point is that they're seeking an award even though they're not a party.
But not a party to the case. No, but they're still a party in the concept of the sense, in the general idea of the sense. They still are a party.
Party to what?
Right. They are a party that is, I guess another word would be an entity, an applicant, would be another word for it, I think.
Correct, so but that's the whole point. They wrote, the reason that they had to add perhaps a party or public entity seeking an award under this section is because it didn't say an entity seeking an award under this section. It said a party. And here, the public entity is not a party to the case, and they're still allowed to submit to request fees under the new A2.
Correct. Yeah. And I would, so I guess the one other thing I would say about this is that, you know, if this is unclear, and I think we were getting into the intent of the legislature here, I think this goes to our argument that there was no express waiver by the legislature of this sovereign immunity.
We were only talking about the plain text of C right. and A2. So your reading of C is that the word party doesn't mean a party to the case. It means a party to something else.
Not a party to something else, just a party, someone who is seeking the award, whether or not they are a part of the case or not.
So then would anyone, even if the public entity was not required to provide for the defense, could anyone who's completely unrelated to the case, not a party to the case, come seek fees under C? Forget about against a public entity, just an unrelated human who wants to seek fees in the case, even though they were not a party to the case.
No, I would say it'd be limited to a public entity because they're specifically included in A2. So they're the only ones other than someone who is a party to the case that could seek those fees.
If we disagree with you on the sovereign immunity argument, is there any other basis for immunity to the barrel?
I'm sorry, you just raised the sovereign immunity. So I guess we go to the next. I guess I suppose I would go to the presumption in favor of public entities. There is an overall presumption of validity of municipal actions, which other litigants do not receive. There are additional immunities that public entities receive statutorily with things like the TCA. We cannot say I don't believe that we can say that as a blanket rule that they are meant to be treated the same.
We have here a question of statutory interpretation. Do we not, or is a public entity such as your client in or out of the FLS?
That's correct.
So the general presumption that a municipality accident in a manner that's consonant with its statutory authority is really not the essence of this question, as it is, what did the legislature intend when it passed this and amended this particular statute?
Well, I think it goes beyond that a little bit in the sense of that the Constitution, the state Constitution specifically requires, and I'll quote from it, the provision of this Constitution and of any law concerning municipal corporations formed for local government shall be liberally construed in their favor.
Right. But what we have here is a review of the propriety of a judicial determination with respect to whether frivolous litigation sanctions are available to your client. That's really the essence of what we're doing.
Correct. Yes.
Do we really apply a presumption that the litigants who are disputing a trial court's decision, one of them is a municipal corporation, that it's correct? In other words, we're not dealing here with a municipal act, ordinance, or something along those lines that would be entitled to a presumption.
Well, it's the interpretation, I would say, the interpretation of the FLS, we would suggest under the Constitution has to be liberally construed in their favor in the sense of, I think it goes as far as whether or not it even applies to public entities.
The provision of the Constitution that you just referenced referred to a municipality as a municipal corporation, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So I thought that you were making an argument, I thought, under the statute, because the word person is used, that limits who can be a party. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so then when I go to NJSA 1:1-2, and I look up the word person, mm-hmm. it says the word person includes corporations, and then it says municipality, semicolon, municipal corporation. So if the word person includes corporations and a municipality is a municipal corporation, then wouldn't you also be included in the word person?
So I'll say a municipal corporation is different from that section of the statute refers to corporations. It separately defines corporations and it separately defines municipal corporations. They're not necessarily the same thing. Now, one of the other things that statute says, and this is also in the JH versus Mercer County that was cited by one of the respondents, that the definition should also be viewed. They're not necessarily a municipal corporation is not necessarily exactly the same as a corporation if it has to be restricted by its context. Or distinguished as a municipal entity or specifically restricted to such an entity. So we would suggest.
Sorry, I'm looking at JH, I think specifically at page 4 and 22. And I thought what JH said is a county, comma, as a municipal corporation, comma, is a corporation included within the definition of person contained in NJSA 1:1-2 thus constitutes a person.
It then goes on to say that interpretation is unless it is restricted by its context to an individual or as distinguished from a corporate entity or specifically restricted to such an entity. And so our argument is that the context of the phrase persons in the FLS in conjunction with the definition, the inclusion of things like public entity, that it is restricted by its context. And so that is, you know, on its, that context is what separates the municipal corporation from any other type of litigant, any other type of person, I should say.
So you're saying that in certain contexts, a municipal corporation is a corporation and therefore a person under 1:1-2. But in other contexts, it's not.
Correct. And I believe that's.
So where do we find that from any of the statutes?
So I believe that is in 1:1-2 itself.
Are you referring to the part where it says when used to designate the owner of property?
No, that's that. I'm sorry. It's in under the definition of person in 1:1-2. It says, as well as individuals, unless restricted by the context to an individual as distinguished from a corporate entity or specifically restricted to one or some of the above enumerated synonyms. And that's what the JH case is citing to.
Sorry, so you're actually saying that here, when it says in the frivolous litigation statute, the word persons, it only applies to individuals. So if it was a corporation that acted frivolously, it would not apply.
No, we're saying it involves, because the definition of persons also includes.
If you could slow down just a bit.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
No, the definition also does include corporations, companies, associates, size. What we're saying is that it distinguishes, that we are distinguishing municipal corporations from corporations because of the context within the FLS itself.
Because of the language, unless restricted by the context.
That's exactly right.
That's referring to individuals and how they're distinguished from corporate entities.
I think that's what the JH case, I think, explains, or I should say distinguishes, and says that it's not just about individuals, that it's in the context of the municipal corporation as well.
Are you seeking immunity under 2A15-60?
No, we're not. I think it applies just to the state itself and its agencies.
Okay.
I think that's all I have at this point, unless there are further questions.
Any questions? Thank you. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Ms. Myers.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Council for the Borough of Inglewood addressed why the FLS should not be applied to the municipalities, but the Attorney General appears amicus, primarily to discuss that sovereign immunity bars the application of the FLS to the state for the recovery of attorney's fees and costs against the state. Sovereign immunity exists to empower government officials to serve the public good without fear of litigation.
I'm going to stop you because the first thing you said is that the FLS, that sovereign immunity bars the seeking of frivolous litigation costs against the state. This is not the state that's a party here. It's the borough or Inglewood Cliffs. So this is a municipality. How does sovereign immunity apply to the borough?
Well, I would defer primarily to the arguments that were made by the Council for the Borough of Inglewood, but there are...
So that means you argue that sovereign immunity does apply to municipalities, despite U.S. Supreme Court case law saying that it does not, and that it only applies to states and the United States?
Primarily, the Attorney General is appearing here amicus to ensure that there's a carve-out that there for the FLS as to the state. And
what you're trying to ensure the court is precise and does not lump the state and municipalities together.
That is correct, Your Honor.
You also make the argument, in your brief that 2A:15-60 creates a conflict with the frivolous litigation statute, I think for purposes of the borough. How does Section 60 apply to the borough as a municipality?
Well, in 2A:15-60, I would argue that it applies to the state, not that it applies to the municipalities.
Do you have any arguments to present today that apply to the borough? Understanding, as you've made clear, that you're here primarily to say that the state is entitled to sovereign immunity, hasn't waived it, etc. But are there arguments that you've made several arguments that you are representing should apply to the borough as well as the state?
Correct, Your Honor. We're here primarily just to ensure that there's a carve out for the state, not necessarily make arguments on behalf of the borough.
No, I'm not saying you're representing them, but is there any argument that you're making in your brief or today that you are asking us to apply to the borough as well as to the state if a similar case were to come up with respect to the state?
The state, no, because the state is in a distinct position from the borough of Inglewood here.
Thank you. Okay. Any questions? Is there something you wish to add?
No, Your Honors. I think Your Honors understand the position of the state is that they would be entitled to sovereign immunity unless there was a clear and unequivocal waiver of that immunity under the FLS, which is not present here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Boxer.
May it please the court. There's no dispute in this case that appellant engaged in frivolous litigation. The issue is whether the appellant can avoid the typical consequences of that misconduct because it was driven by a public official as opposed to a private party. In other words, whether my clients are left without a remedy and are denied reimbursement. Nothing in the frivolous litigation statute requires such a result. And I'll turn to the statutory language in a moment, but I would like to begin with what we respectfully submit should be the common sense result here. No one, whether a private party or a public entity, should be allowed to pursue bad faith, frivolous litigation with impunity. A public entity pursuing frivolous litigation is no less culpable than any other party. In a way, it's even scarier for the party on the receiving end, and the victim of such a filing should be compensated for their expenses, we submit. When a public entity brings the force of the government to bear against a private party, those public officials are not reaching into their own pockets to fund the effort. They do not have the same incentive that private litigants do to think twice about whether financing the suit makes sense. Using public resources, they're already a bit removed from the consequence of their actions. If the frivolous litigation statute does not apply to public entities, the incentives regarding litigating in our civil courts would be skewed. So, in the rare case in which a public entity acts in bad faith, we submit that common sense dictates that the victim should be made whole. The culpable party should have to explain themselves to their constituents. The frivolous litigation statute is an important safeguard, which then brings us to the question, is there anything in the language of the statute that would require the counterintuitive result that the appellant is seeking here? We believe emphatically the answer to that question is no. The language does not exclude public entities in any way, quite the opposite. Subsection A1 provides that a party who prevails in a civil case against, quote, any other party can recover reasonable attorney's fees if the court finds the litigation was frivolous. Subsection B again uses the phrase non-prevailing party. It does not say any other private party. It does not say any party except public entities. If the legislature intended to exclude public entities, surely it knew how to use ordinary phrases like that to do so. Appellant points to the phrase public entity in subsection A2, arguing that the use of that phrase somehow changes the meaning of, quote, any other party. But A2 addresses a very specific situation where a public entity is not a party to the case, but is nonetheless required by law to pay defense costs for one of its employees. There's nothing surprising, there's nothing superfluous about A2. It actually has nothing to do with the situation currently before this court. Nor is there anything in the legislative history of the 1988 enactment of the statute to suggest that use of the phrase any party was mistaken. Statute was amended in 1995. There's nothing in the legislative history of the 1995 amendment that would indicate that. At the time of that amendment, the Chancery Division had already ruled that the frivolous litigation statute applies to public entities. Would have been a reasonable time to fix the statute if the legislature had disagreed. It did not do so. So that brings us to the question of, well, what is it that the appellant appears to be relying on here? They're relying on the legislature's use of the word person in one instance in the frivolous litigation statute, person versus party. Assuming for the sake of argument, there actually is a distinction, it may have been no more than a legislative oversight. But even if it were intentional, the outcome that we are respectfully putting before the court would have been the same. Person, as the court noted in its prior questions, person is defined by our statutory code. The definition includes corporations. And we know that under state law, corporations includes municipal corporations, such as appellant. And therefore, in this case, the reference to a non-prevailing person applies here. So in sum, considering common sense, plain language, legislative history, statutory definitions, we believe the appellate division correctly determined that the statute allows for sanctions against public entities. And in this rare case, the borough is liable for those sanctions. Happy to address any questions the court has.
In PM, Judge Fisher, obviously we have two Chancery Division cases going in opposite directions. And Judge Fisher view the 1995 amendments to resolve any lingering doubt about the import of the statute, and noted that A2 would be an odd step if the pre-existing statute had included the state and its agencies. What is wrong with that analysis?
A2 covered a very specific situation where a municipality is not a party, but is covering the cost and expenses in the matter. If A2 had not been added to the statute, then municipalities would have been unable to seek compensation on the receiving end of a frivolous litigation when they're financially on the hook for the matter, even though that they were not a party. We think the PM case is, in some cases, frankly, we respectfully disagree with that decision. In other cases, I would note, in other ways, it's distinguishable. I'll note a couple things in that regard. First off, the PM case involved the state. This is a very different situation, does not involve a state agency. And so the definition of person that I referred to applies to municipalities here, such as the borough. There's also the distinctions that were referenced before in terms of sovereign immunity as between the state and a municipality. Very different situation to be talking about a municipality as we are in our case. I'd also note that the PM case focused on NJSA 2A:50-60, but that statute pertains to costs, not fees. Those are two different things. And the court in PM did not speak to that. And so we believe that the PM decision was, as I say, wrongly decided, but even if not, doesn't apply here.
What is your position with respect to the state of the law regarding municipalities and sovereign immunity in New Jersey?
So one of the more recent decisions in that regard is the Willis case from this court from 1970, where the court noted that sovereign immunity, when it comes to municipalities, if there is sovereign immunity, it's much more limited than it is as to the state. If I may make a broader point as to sovereign immunity as well, this case is not about a government entity acting as the government and needing immunity so that it can carry out its responsibilities as a government. Like we saw in the PM case, where maybe the court was affected by this fact that we're talking about DIFAS, who has a very difficult job to do. I think we'd all agree. This is not the state or government carrying out a government function and needing protection. This is a local government acting as a litigant, an aggressive litigant, a highly aggressive litigant in your courts.
And that's understood, obviously. But the obviously the significance of the sovereign immunity point is that the waiver of sovereign immunity has to be an express waiver, and that's really a major pillar of your adversary's argument. So. The question that obviously came up a little bit earlier is, are municipalities treated differently from the state? And Justice Wiener Apter noted the U.S. Supreme Court law. Is there a case on point or a case close to on point on the general question, leaving aside the particular type of statute and the particular act by the municipality that suggests that there is precedent in state law that allows municipalities to claim sovereign immunity?
No compelling precedent that I'm aware of that allows that. The precedent that I've seen talks about how municipalities are treated differently for purposes of sovereign immunity, such as the Willis case. We certainly understand the general idea that sovereign immunity, if it applies, has to be waived. But I think the first question we would respectfully submit before the court is, does it apply? When you're talking about a municipality, and we don't believe it does, when you're talking about especially a municipality that's not carrying out a government function, and particularly when we're talking about the context of court-imposed sanctions, if the government is going to come into court and use the courts, it should not be cloaked with special status in that regard. If it were, then Superior Court judges would be limited in reining in improper conduct in your courts. This court has held primacy over the court rules for a reason, to guard against conduct like this, to control conduct in our courts. So I say that all to say, Justice Patterson, that I don't know that sovereign immunity even applies when we're talking about a court-imposed sanction regarding conduct in the courts itself.
But we wouldn't need to reach, for example, whether sovereign immunity could apply to the state in such a context. We wouldn't need to reach whether the state could be liable under the FLS at all in order to rule in your favor, correct?
Correct. Correct. And then a separate basis to rule in our favor would be, again, even if you disagree with everything I just said about sovereign immunity, we also do believe that the frivolous litigation statute constitutes a waiver. It says any party. But to your question, Justice, no, we don't need to get to that.
Any questions? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Boxer?
No, other than thanking the court for its consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wunsch?
Thank you. Good afternoon. I find myself in a very unique situation here where I'm actually arguing about the town that I love, the town that I still live in. I'm a fifth generation of Englewood Cliffs. My family founded the town that we have here in 1895. And what happened in this case is appalling. We have a situation here where I stand before you, as I said, not only a resident, but a victim. A victim of a vicious assault by a mayor, whose name I will not use, that was attacking us personally, professionally, and everything down the line.
Mr. Wunsch, we have a legal question before the court, and we'd like you to address that if you would. Your colleague has addressed it already, and that is whether or not the borough of Englewood Cliffs is in or out of the frivolous litigation. Whether or not Englewood, the borough, is included or in or excluded from the frivolous litigation statute?
No, It's included in, because here's the situation. There has to be some form of carrot and stick with regards to a municipality that goes forward on something that was baseless, something that was an attack on the professional careers of four attorneys, okay, that were beyond reproach with regards to their expertise.
And what is your argument with respect to the language of the frivolous litigation statute?
It involves why
we should say that the borough is included, because that's
it
the
involves a person. Okay, it involves persons. Okay,
okay.
And of course, the municipal corporation, we've already gone through that, is included with regards to same. And with regards to that,
I'm sorry, it's included in persons.
Well, municipal corporation, it's the definition, if we look at, believe it was, forget the statute on it, but it is definitely inclusive. And in this instance, what happened was a lawsuit with no basis in fact whatsoever. I mean, they came in with this law firm. They're arguing about the fact that this has a bad effect on the residents of Englewood Cliffs because of the fact that they have to pay this. Yet they brought in the Cadwalader law firm at $1,200 an hour. Okay, so how do you make that argument? $1.2 million in fees. How do you make that argument? Now, we defeated Cadwalader, and you know, you remember that Alexander Hamilton started there, but we didn't give them their shot. They didn't get that chance to come after us. We got them out. But they continued to go forward with regards to this. And they put four attorneys into an ethical dilemma where they were being looked upon by the ethics committee because of this complaint and attacked professionally. And every chance that this mayor had, he went on air talking about the fact that we were being sued for $100 million. $100 million. And attacking people, like I said, Jeff Serenian, expert in the field, Tom Trautner, same thing, Joe Marinello, myself.
Okay. Do you have anything to say further about the issue that's before the court, which is whether or not a municipality is within the frivolous litigation statute?
Yes, and the point is this: you have to set the table before you can serve the dinner. What happened here, okay, is the reason why we have to make sure that municipalities have some skin in the game. There's a reason why we have to make sure that they don't get immunity. You're not going to allow a circumstance here where an individual can come in with the amount of resources that a municipality has to attack. The immunity is not there. You know, it says that we always take a look at a situation that, you know, you've got bad actors here. We can't let bad actors make bad law. We can't have an opportunity where they come in and get an immunity. This individual went forward with regards to a very, very vengeful retaliatory attack. And if the municipality is given the chance to skate on that, then who's responsible for this behavior? This man cannot get this immunity. This town cannot get this immunity. And granted, I'm only talking about $327.20. That's all I got with regards to this case, which if your honors argue quickly against me, I actually have the cash with me and we can pay that off then. But the situation is that this is a very, very, very trying situation that should not be given an immunity. There's nothing with regards to what Mr. Boxer set forth that denies them the opportunity to not take responsibility for their actions. The frivolous lawsuit, I have been involved with these cases numerous times, usually don't get it. But in this case, thankfully, the judge saw that this needed to be taken care of. And I apologize for being emotional, like I said before. We've lived with this case. I was in the trenches in this case. No one else was that's here. And it's a very, very emotionally draining experience.
Any questions?
It was a pleasure speaking to y'all.
Anything you'd like to add, sir?
Let's see. In the spirit of the day, I say no, nay, never to municipal immunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosenberg.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I'll be brief. On the statutory construction issue, even if Englewood Cliffs was correct in its very strained definition of persons, this court would have to believe that the legislature, by use of the word persons, intended to write out of the statute the phrase any other party, which is what the frivolous litigation statute is all about. And that begs common sense. And also, we know how the legislature deals with that situation. And we know about it because of 2A15-60. One of the things that I don't think has been mentioned in any of the briefs is that the obvious reason for 2A15-60 was 2A15-59, not 59.1, but 2A15-59. That statute is a statute that authorizes the court to assess taxable costs against any party. The phrase is any party. Obviously, the phrase any party includes all parties, including the state, including public entities. And that's why the legislature then had to enact 15-60, which I believe was enacted at the same time as 15-59, in order to make sure that the state was excluded from the phrase any party. It did not do that under the frivolous litigation statute. Our position, and Mr. Boxer skillfully set it forth, is consonant with common sense, that the legislature could not possibly have decided that certain parties can litigate frivolously with impunity, while other parties are going to be subject to the same sanctions for the same sort of action. And it's not as if Englewood Cliffs or even the state has ever suggested why the legislature would do that. And there is no good reason why it would do that when the overall purpose of the statute is, and there's no dispute about this, is to deter frivolous litigation. It's not as if there's going to be an avalanche of, of cases brought against public entities or motions for fees against public entities that hasn't happened when the weight of constructive, of contemporaneous construction has not led to that slew of cases.
Your adversary, Mr. Salmon argues that when we see the reference to a non-prevailing person among several references to non-prevailing party, then person informs the meaning of party. Why are they wrong about that?
Well, I think it's a choice that this court has to make between person, non-prevailing person, meaning non-prevailing party, which seems to be consistent with the thrust of the entire statute, as opposed to the very subtle use of the word person by the legislature to completely undercut the phrase any other party, which is what the first phrase of this of the FLS is. It doesn't make sense. Now, I don't know why the legislature did that. They might have made a mistake. They might have thought person had the common meaning. And quite frankly, even if we were going to deal with the definition of person according to Englewood Cliffs, NJSA 1:1-2 specifies that you shouldn't use the definitions in a way that's repugnant to the statute as a whole. And the statute as a whole is intended to deter frivolous litigation. The other point I wanted to make quickly is one of the reasons that there's not going to be an avalanche of successful motions under the frivolous litigation statute is because of the very strong standards that the legislature put in, extraordinarily high standards as to what frivolousness is. And what this court did in 1:4-8, setting forth very detailed procedures, including notice and an opportunity to retract before a motion could be made. And this is important when we deal with the sovereign immunity question. And initially, Justice Wagner-Apter, you're 100% right on the issue of municipalities not having sovereign immunity. And Mr. Boxer referred to the Willis case. There's language I'll quote from Willis, and I think it's at page 55 NJ, I think at 539. We have long entertained all types of tort actions against counties and municipalities, and when relief is refused, is upon the basis of substantive principles of law we think should apply and not upon the proposition that those agencies are immune from suit. And that's right from Willis. Now, quite frankly, even if it were not for that, I don't think this is necessarily a sovereign immunity issue. Every one of the cases that both the state and Englewood Cliffs cites, Abamont and Pritchett and Allen versus Falver and Royster, all deal with whether or not the state should be hailed into court for money damages in a civil suit under tort or contract. As Mr. Boxer said, this is a very different situation. Here, the public entities are already in court. Under the frivolous litigation statute, they might be plaintiffs themselves coming into court. They might be defendants, but if they're defendants, it has nothing to do with waiver of sovereign immunity at that point. They're in because they've been sued under a claim that's already recognized that they're allowed to be sued. In that regard, the Royster case, which was cited by the state in its amicus brief, is kind of interesting because there, this court recognized that there might be a waiver of sovereign immunity, even by the state, by intentional litigation conduct, quote, litigation conduct, end quote. I would suggest that the FOS actually has kind of a self-executing waiver of sovereign immunity.
But again, the court doesn't have to.
Court does not have to deal with that issue. But if the sovereign immunity issue is alive as Englewood Cliffs, it would have to deal with it. And I would just suggest that
Royster involves, sovereign immunity.
I'm sorry.
Royster involves sovereign immunity applying to the state, correct?
That's right. And on that, it was also a federal ADA claim, not even a state claim, which is why they applied federal law, but they recognized the possibility of intentional waiver on the basis of litigation conduct. And this court's rule 14-8 by allowing a litigant to escape liability, I think is kind of a self-executing waiver, if not assumption of risk. Because if the party, any public entity, declines to seize the opportunity to withdraw, to retract a challenge pleading is frivolous, then I think ultimately if that pleading is found to meet the very high standards of frivolousness, then there has been an intentional waiver of sovereign immunity by purposeful litigation conduct. We urge that the appellate division, that the Supreme Court affirm the appellate division and find that public entities are subject to the FLS. If there are any questions, happy to entertain them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg. Brief rebuttal, please.
There's one point I just want to address that the respondents indicated that if the court overturns the previous decision, that there's no other remedy. They have no other option or way of seeking recourse. I just want to point out that it's not true. Under 148, Rule 148 itself, there are sanctions available to the attorneys that are representing public entities. The borough is not contesting that. Clearly, the court has the jurisdiction to sanction those sanctioned attorneys and therefore disincentivize the bringing of any frivolous cases in that way. The Attorney General's brief also points out that there are also cause of action for malicious prosecution as well that remain an option. The legislature recently passed the anti-SLAPP statute, which provides litigants with another option.
I saw that. Could a cause of action for malicious prosecution apply here?
Could it apply here in a legal sense or a factual sense?
Well, there's no prosecution.
Sure. In this specific case, then no. But in, I guess it depends on what the nature of the case is. So
that wouldn't be a remedy available to these.
In these specific ones, no. We would suggest that Rule 148 in that sanctions can be brought against the attorneys involved. That is one. The anti-SLAPP statute was adopted or was signed into law after this case began. But that is another option for litigants as well. So I just want to point out there are other remedies available. The legislature has made it clear that in other circumstances that there are options available.
Mr. Rosenberg makes a good point about litigation conduct and Royster. I know a little bit about Royster. I was the dev judge that wrote that. What about that point?
I'm sorry.
What about the whole point about litigation conduct?
Litigation conduct, I guess I'm not sure which part.
Borough filed a complaint.
Yeah. So I'll go back to that there are other options available under 148 against attorneys. I'm sorry. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question.
In terms of sovereign immunity.
In terms of a waiver or something like that. I think that the sovereign immunity there, that relates to the claim itself, not the whether this statute is specifically available. That under the sovereign immunity principles, this statute itself, because they're not bringing the borough in this case or any public entity is not bringing a cause of action under the frivolous litigation statute. They're bringing it under something else. So any sort of waiver would only apply to that, whatever the cause of action is that they're bringing, not the separate thing that's the public entity isn't bringing the frivolous litigation statute. So I would say that doesn't apply. Doesn't apply to this other statute.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and the court's in recess for the day.